Okay, we'll call the Judiciary Committee to order. It's 4 minutes after 1:30, Friday. We're Friday, the 28th of January. We have two members absent today because they're off traveling, Senator Costello and Senator Meyer, but we have Senator Kelly with us, the President of the Senate. We have Senator Wilkowski with us and myself, Senator Coghill. Today, the method of this particular meeting was to get implementations on Senate Bill 91 in front of us. So a couple of the issues you'll hear about are going to be what were some of the implementation issues and what were some of the issue implementation timelines. And so I have the court system that's going to come before us today and talk about their particular issues. Then I'll have Diane Castro from the Behavioral Health Department of Health and Social Services, I'm sorry. Then we'll have the ASAP statewide program manager, Tony Piper, come before us. And I forgot to mention Nancy Mead from the court. I'm sorry, Nancy. And then Jess Jesse will come with the Mental Health Trust Board, which I think he was just closing out the Criminal Justice Commission meeting where they were making some recommendations, by the way, which I hope to bring before the committee on Monday, at least if it's not in exact writing, it'll be in topics that we will probably be dealing with. So today, and where our meeting is scheduled from 1:30 to 3, but this is just invited testimony only. It was meant to show what are some of the implementation things that have been happening, what has to happen, what's the work in progress, and what are some of the things that we might want to keep an eye on. So why don't we have the court system, Nancy Mead, who's a general counsel for the court system, come before us at this point, and then we'll go down the list, and we have right after her will be Diane Castro, and then we'll get to Tony Piper. So thank you, Nancy, for coming before us. Put yourself on the record and give us your testimony, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, and I was asked to address the committee on three general areas today. The first is implementation steps and the process that the court went through after the passage of SB 91 last July. Secondly, implementation issues or areas of concern that we've noted that the committee may want to address in its discretion at its next few meetings as part of another bill. And thirdly, to address and respond to questions about the statewide bail schedule, which I understand may have be causing some misunderstanding and or confusion with the public and law enforcement. So I'll be happy to do that. And if with the
let you know, Nancy, that we have also with us Senator Hughes, who's very interested in what the implementation issues are here. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll start just with the implementation tasks that the court system has undertaken. As members of the legislature, I'm sure, know, at the end of a session, each of the agencies and the court system goes back and does what it needs to do to ensure that the laws that were just passed are used by that agency. The role of the judges, of course, is to apply the laws that you pass. I view my role within the court system as general counsel in ensuring that the judges know what those laws are. It's a big task when you have a 122-page bill. So I begin by writing a memo to the judges. Here's what's changed. Here's what you might expect to see. And I do any materials for the judges that I think may be helpful. For example, after the passage of SB 91, I updated the penalty checklist, which is about a 12-page document that judges use on the bench to help them have a more or less shortcut cheat sheet, if you will, when they are imposing sentences for different crimes. So since SB 91 changed those sentences, that took a bit of work to put together. I also summarized the applicability section. Section 185 of the bill is 5 pages long. It has subsections A through V, and it has different applicabilities for all the different sections of the bill. And that was quite a bit of a task, and some of it was confusing to me at least, but we put that together so that people would be on the same page, so to speak, and know what laws applied to what offenses, depending on when that behavior offense took place. As I explained to the judges in my memo and then in three different oral presentations, the bill can be divided basically into three phases, and there are a few outliers, but generally in SB 91, a whole bunch of things went into effect on July 12th. A second set of changes went into effect on January 1st of this year, just 3 or 4 weeks ago, and then a whole set of changes, mostly having to do with pretrial, have not gone into effect yet, but will go into effect in January of 2018. So whenever I talk about the bill, I think of those three phases, and so last July, mostly, of course, we are focused on those changes that would become effective right away. The court system also determined that it was very helpful for the judges and the criminal process in general if the attorneys and probation officers and others who are involved in the criminal justice system understood what the bill said and what the judges were told the bill said. And in recognition of that, I did three presentations in Anchorage to the any prosecutors and defense attorneys who wanted to attend. Those were quite well attended, and therefore they could hear the same hour and a half presentation that I had given to the judges and ask their questions at that event. Following that, I spoke to the Alaska State Troopers, and there were about 60 people in attendance out at the crime lab in Anchorage, and they were able to hear again what the judges had been told that the bill did. I then followed up with presentations in Juneau, Fairbanks, Palmer, Bethel, and Kenai, and gave a 1 to 2 hour talk on what the bill has in it. Earlier in the summer, I focused on just the changes that were in effect then, and then it became a 2 hour presentation as I talked about everything that would be coming as well. I responded to questions at those as best I could, and as the committee is probably aware, I shied away from any support from the bill or any criticism of the bill, viewing the court system's role in simply applying the bill and, again, helping people understand exactly what was in there. And also, the public defender's office and the prosecutor's office were invited to all those talks. So it was absolutely neutral and just factual, I believe. So that was what we did to kind of roll things out in an outreach and education sort of way. In the court system's administrative office, we have held and continue to hold weekly two-hour meetings every Thursday afternoon to implement the bill. This would include myself and our court rules attorney, and in response to this bill, four rules have been amended or had usage notes added so far. Our court forms attorneys, and we have one and a part-time one, although the part-time one does the work of a full-time one. So, kind of two full-time forms attorneys. In response to this bill, they revised or added 74 forms. And each of those forms has to be approved legally. They're both attorneys, so that they say exactly what's in the bill, but also has to be approved by the judges. They have to be easy to use. They have to be easy to understand, et cetera. So each one of those changes or new forms takes quite a bit of work. As just one example, the SB 91 allowed for limited driver's licenses for people in certain circumstances. If they live in a place with a therapeutic court, there's one procedure, and if they live in a place where there isn't therapeutic court, they can file a request for a hearing and then have a hearing where they try to establish for the judge that they are sober and have been sober for 18 months, and therefore they can get a certification that they then take to the Division of Motor Vehicles and see if they can fulfill the other requirements, such as having the appropriate insurance and having an ignition interlock. So that might seem like a very simple fix. We worked on a form that the public can understand, a request for hearing. It has to be simple language, it has to be straightforward, and it has to tell them all the steps that they're going to have to take. And we had to work with DMV, so that was about three meetings with DMV representatives. And I guess the only reason I'm putting this out there is it was a process, and it was done in conjunction with other agencies, and getting agreement on everything that had to be in all those forms was quite a task. The other thing I wanted to stress is it continues to be a process. As we see things that might not be working as well as others want them to be, we are very open and do consistently fix things. And that might be a judge saying, you know, this shouldn't be a checkbox on the form. It always has to be ordered. So get rid of the checkbox. Then you won't have people maybe not ordering it, as if it's an optional thing. And again, just examples of the sorts of work we've done. As you know, first-time DUI people now do not spend their time in a hard bed, but are on electronic monitoring or house arrest. So all our DUI judgment forms had to be changed to allow for that to be ordered. And something everyone doesn't realize, but we always have to order, according to statute, a cost of imprisonment. Well, there's a different cost if you're in jail versus if you're on electronic monitoring. So that took a series of meetings with the probation office to say, where should the court send people when they're convicting or sentencing them for their first time DUI? So those are just a few of the examples. We also had to amend court view input data instructions for our clerks, and a good number of instructions, and several teleconferences with clerks statewide. And again, I don't say this to say you gave us a lot of work. I'm only saying this to show that it's a process that we continue to undertake. This was a large bill, and we do want to make sure that everybody knows what's going on with it. So those internal meetings were one step. The external meetings with DPS, for example, with DMV, with DOC, were some of the other things we did. We also are required by the bill to provide certain data to the Criminal Justice Commission staffed by the Judicial Council. And that has been a task for our single person in our IS department who pulls data when requested, and that she's had a good number of meetings to make sure that she's doing that appropriately and as the bill requires. Okay, so through this process, we have encountered a couple of issues that we thought might be appropriate for the legislature to take a look at. And some of these, if not all, have been brought to the attention of the Criminal Justice Commission so that they may make a recommendation to you to fix these as well. And I will say that the court system has not made any suggestions for changes in the large policy areas or substantive areas. So to the extent you've heard of constituents, for example, thinking something in the bill policy-wise was not appropriate, that is not something the court system would comment on. We, you know, as you know, just apply the bill. But there are a few less policy-laden areas that at the chair's invitation, I'd like to address right now.
Absolutely. Thank you, Nancy.
Okay. And I have provided to committee members a packet of selected statutes, and you don't have to go through it. I know some people are oral listeners, and some might want to see it on the piece of paper. I don't intend for this to be overwhelming. I'm hoping it just makes it a little more straightforward as we run through some of these. And as I mentioned to the chair before the meeting, we all just came from another Criminal Justice Commission meeting where they reviewed these, and I don't want to be terribly repetitive, and I may go a little bit fast, but obviously stop me whenever you wish or speed me up.
Just to let people know, my intention is to go over the commission recommendations as soon as I can possibly get them. I'm hoping I'm going to have them Monday. If I can't have them in some easy-to-digest form Monday, then we'll do it later. But if we can get it in written form and it's digestible by this committee and in the policy topics, then we'll have it in front of the committee. So, but I like the way you did this. You took the statute number, you put a big circle around it, and made it pretty easy to get to. So thank you very much, Nancy.
Certainly. Okay, to start then, and I'm going to, I just am speaking to the actual words of the bill, and I'm going to refer to the handwritten numbers in the bottom in circles, which I just wrote on there. So page one of the packet shows you the violation of condition of release provisions. There's two sections of the bill, 29 and 30, that at the commission's recommendation made violation of condition of release into a violation. It was formerly a crime, and that was based on their information that this was one of the less serious offenses that people can commit, and that a violation was a more appropriate way to handle these offenses. And the legislature indeed adopted the commission's recommendation on that. This is just one area where I do know the commission will be recommending a change. It has proven to be in the last 6 months quite difficult to implement and quite difficult logistically. and it might be something that instead does need some jail time. And here's kind of the crux of it. If something in the law cannot be jailable, as a violation cannot, this is a violation, the maximum penalty is $1,000. When somebody is arrested for that behavior, and there is a specific provision saying you can be arrested, the jail didn't want to keep them. How can you keep somebody on bail pre-trial if there's no possibility of jail time later? And we've worked through a couple of different ways to address that. And I'll back up a tiny bit. A violation of condition of release occurs when a person has been arrested previously for a felony or misdemeanor and has bail conditions. And one of those conditions might be, for example, to not drink alcohol if the crime, alleged crime, was alcohol-related or was done well under the influence of alcohol. Well, the person gets released with that condition and maybe well out on bail, they indeed do have alcohol, and a law enforcement officer encounters them. So they are violating that condition of their release. So the problem was, if they brought them to the jail and there was no jailable time for it, nobody quite knew how to handle that for a couple of weeks. There were some glitches in the system, frankly. The Anchorage jail wouldn't accept them. But this doesn't change how law enforcement could arrest the people. They could still arrest the people for this. It just was difficult for them to keep the people that had committed this offense. So, again, I do believe that the Criminal Justice Commission, having reviewed the problems that have been inherent in this change, may be recommending to you that there should be some jail time affiliated with it, and that would alleviate the logistical concerns the court had in deciding what to do with these people when brought up for their arraignment on this or their first hearing on this offense. So that's kind of quick. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I will also say that you'll be hearing about this in the next week or so, according to the chairman.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Okay, I will flip to the page 2. Page 2 looks at section 65 of SB 91, and this is quite minor in my opinion, and this is a provision that the legislature inserted to say that at the time of sentencing, the court shall provide the victim with a form telling them basically how to be kept abreast of what's happening with the offender, how to change their address with the Department of Corrections, which has the victim information network. It's VINE, it's an acronym, it's something like Victim Information Network. I don't know what the E is. Victims can go on there and learn when their offender might be released on parole, administrative parole, or other things. So this seemed very logical to have the court at the sentence tell the victim how to get involved with this system to ensure that they know what's going on if they want to know what's going on. The slight problem we encountered as we tried to implement this is it says the court shall provide the victim with a form. Well, the court doesn't have victim's information. If the person is there at the sentencing, we've been complying with this. This is in effect. We created the form, victim information form, and we hand it to anybody at a sentencing. And in fact, if a victim is on the phone, the judge says, here's how you can get information, and directs them to our website. The form is prominent on our website. That is, if you type in the word victim to the search bar, it's the first thing that shows up, and we doctored up the search engine so that that would happen. So that we made every effort to comply with this. However, I mean, the strict wording says the court shall provide the victim, but we couldn't provide it to victims who weren't present or to victims who declined to be involved in a prosecution, which happens commonly, or not uncommonly at least. So the Criminal Justice Commission discussed this and did understand, I think, the problem and didn't want to have the court system have to do an impossible task. And so I believe the change you'll be seeing is the court shall make available to the victim if practical. And again, we want to do that, and those are the steps we've undertaken so far to do it. The next change is a bigger change, and I'm on page 3. This is the suspended entry of judgment. This is an alternative means of resolving criminal cases. There is already in the law a suspended imposition of sentence. This is related but different. The suspended imposition of sentence did not go away. But under a suspended entry of judgment, where the prosecution and defense agrees, The offender can plead guilty, usually. It could be after being found guilty, but let's assume they're going to plead guilty. Then the court can just give them probation time and say, if at the end of this, for example, year, if you comply with these conditions, which may be restitution, treatment, whatever, your case will be dismissed. And when that case is dismissed, it's going to come off court view so that the person doesn't suffer the negative consequences of having a felony or any conviction on their record from that offense. A few gaps arose as we tried to implement this. And again, as discussed by the commission earlier today, there's a question of whether any jail time can be imposed. The commission is going to make a recommendation, yes or no. Again, the court doesn't have any policy position on that, but a clarification would be helpful. And the reason is, with an SIS, the suspended imposition of sentence, there is a specific statute, 1255.086, that says the court may impose a short period of incarceration in connection with this sentence. That same provision doesn't apply to SEJs, and some clarification might be in order to avoid a lot of questions about that. Secondly, the SEJs, if you flip to page 4 in subsection F, excludes a good number of violations. You cannot have your a suspended entry of judgment for certain types of crimes against persons or your second or subsequent felony, et cetera. And that's fine. These are copied basically from the SIS statute, the same sorts of exclusions. But because the SIS statute has been in effect longer and people have more experience with it, there are also exclusions within particular statutes that are not excluded by the SEJ. One example, the main example that's causing questions, is the DUI and refusal statutes. They say within those statutes in Title 28 that an SIS is not available. They don't say an SEJ is not available. And so you could conclude, well, it is. On the other hand, by the legislature adopting all the other exclusions for SISs, perhaps the intent was to exclude even those DUI and refusals. So that might have been an oversight. It's just something that I would put out there. The other thing in subsection F, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, these are the exclusions, and it refers to whether the person is convicted of a violation of certain crimes. I'm not certain, but I believe that the legislature's intent was to have this person not have the consequences of a conviction, and perhaps that language should be "is charged with." And that might seem technical, but earlier in the statute it said the person pleads guilty, and there's law that says if a person pleads guilty of something, they're convicted of something. So we're unclear whether the person is convicted or not during that time period, even if their case gets dismissed. And one of the problems with SIS is people don't know thereafter if they can say they've never been convicted or what they need to say. So clarifying that might help for a couple of different reasons. The other thing, and I'll flip now to page 6, is perhaps another oversight. You can see where I have an arrow there. And this is a statute that says all the things that are authorized, all the things a court can do whenever there's a conviction or anything when they're imposing sentence. And you can see that number 8 says the court may suspend imposition of sentence. This is a kind of a catch-all general instructions about everything a court can do. And it might be good if you had in there that the courts can suspend entry of judgment. So I believe maybe somewhat of a drafting error that that this wasn't captured here, and that would be a bit clarifying and helpful for people. Okay, I'm going to flip to page 7, and this is a DUI penalty provision that appears within the general penalty provisions. Here, this is the section 90 of the bill on my page 7. That discusses the presumptive ranges for C felonies. Presumptive ranges means that that's presumably where the person's sentence will end up, but a person in felonies can prove aggravating factors that allows the court to go above that the top of the range, or mitigating factors that allows the court to sentence somebody for less than the range set in the statute. Well, legislature added certain felony DUI offenses there in lines, looks like about 20 through 25. I might be off on that. I have an old version. And this led to a little bit of confusion because DUI and refusal, unlike most other crimes, has their own penalty provision within their own statutes that define the elements of the offense. So in Title 28, it says that for your first-time felony DUI, you have a minimum of 120 days. And yet, here on page 7, it says that the range is 120 to 239 days. And I do believe the legislature intended simply to add a cap. But now you have one statute saying there's a mandatory minimum and another saying 120 days is the bottom of the range, and you could go below it if with a mitigator. So the legislature may want to rethink whether it intended to get rid of the mandatory minimum in DUI, which that's up to you. But I don't think that I heard testimony last year saying that that was the intent. So that would be perhaps advisable to eliminate those three additions to, it looks like, E, 4, B, C, and D, and instead, if you want a cap, add those all in one place so there aren't two different penalties for the same conduct in two different spots in the statute. Okay? I included the DUI statute to maybe point out where that happens, but I think I probably explained it well enough.
Thank you very much, yes. Get it.
Okay. Okay, and then the next one is on my page 15, so I'm skipping forward. And this is Section 91, the Class A misdemeanor sentences. And those are clear, and there can be aggravators, and there are certain things for which the sentence can go up to 1 year, and then other things for which the sentence can be only 30 days. But there are many statutes, particularly in the Fish and Game title and in Title 28, that say within the statute themselves that, for example, this is an A misdemeanor with a punishment up to 90 days in jail. So there's a little bit of a difficulty in coordinating those two. And I think it would be alleviated quite a bit if just in Section 91 towards the beginning, if it just said, unless otherwise provided in the provision of law defining the offense or something like that. That does appear in Section 92 with the misdemeanor saying this is the penalty unless otherwise provided. And again, that would just be clarifying and prevent people from making the arguments that something else should happen. And again, it's just the legislature, from the court system's point of view, anything you want to decide, as long as it's clear, will stop litigation in that area, maybe. Page 17. Sections 104 and 105 change the law regarding driving with a license suspended, canceled, or revoked. And this, again, was done at the recommendation of the Criminal Justice Commission on the theory that people were spending time in jail for what I'll now refer to as DWLS because there were mandatory jail terms, and perhaps those are not the most violent people that ought to be spending time in jail. So for DUI and refusal, it's still a Class A misdemeanor with specified penalties. But if the driving with your license suspended or revoked was done and the license wasn't suspended or revoked after a DUI, but for some other reason, for example, points because you speed a lot or something and you got your license suspended, then this bill says that it's an infraction. Well, an infraction is punishable by a fine of $300. That's fine, and that was the that works just fine for the court system. But there's another crime that wasn't addressed and perhaps should have been, and maybe it was an oversight, that is driving without a valid operator's license. So if you drive with your license suspended, the max you can get is $300, unless it was DUI. But if you're driving without a valid operator's license, like you just never took the license or you moved here, you just don't have a driver's license, there's a separate statute that prohibits that. That's on my page 19. And then on page 20, it says the punishment for that is no more than $500 or 90 days in jail. So there's a little bit of a problem that came to my attention really from the judges saying this is arguably less serious behavior. You never had your license revoked, and yet the penalty is quite a bit more severe. So that might be something that the legislature would consider addressing. And that, again, on page 20, it is the default penalty provision for things in Title 28 that don't have a particular penalty. and it just says that anything in this chapter, so your driving provisions, can be punishable by up to 90 days, and that may not be quite in keeping with the changes that the legislature intended. So that is the most obvious one, and it would not be a difficult fix, I don't think. Okay, I'm going to go to page 21, and really it just starts on the bottom, section 113, but really page 22. And this was discussed again at the Criminal Justice Commission meeting, and I believe you'll be getting a recommendation on this. This was a provision that the legislature included in SB 91 really so that as you worked so hard to ensure that the proper people were spending time in jail for the proper amount of time, you didn't want municipalities to have penalties that were materially different or more severe so that they could, by their ordinances, have people in jail or have penalties that are worse than what you decided as a policy matter were appropriate. And so it says if the municipality has a penalty for something, it can't be really more severe than it would be under state law if it's a similar offense. And that sounds great, but it did raise two problems for us, and that is whether you intended to include both fines and jail time, because sometimes the municipal fine is higher than the state fine for something, but then also if you intended to cover regulations. And the most obvious area where this is comes into play is with traffic. So the municipality of Anchorage has a traffic ordinance, and this is just an example, that might say it's a $200 fine to go through a flashing red light, whereas under state regulations, not statute, it says that the penalty for that is $150. So one reading of this is that the city couldn't charge $200 anymore. And this became problematic because from our point of view, I mean, the cities had their own problems with it, but from the court system's point of view, we process nearly all cities' default traffic tickets. So when you get a ticket with the municipality of Anchorage, you can go down and just pay it, some people do ignore it. And when it's ignored, after a certain number of days pass, they give it to the court and ask for a default judgment so they can then collect on it. Well, it was problematic for us to figure out how much to enter on that default judgment, the $200 that the city charged, or would our judges be violating the law, and when really they can only give $150. So we've asked for clarification on that. I don't believe you intended to cover regulations or traffic, and I think you'll be hearing more about that from the commission as well. Okay? I will flip to... Let me just flip to my page 23. And this, I included all of section 170 of SB 91. These are the duties of DHSS, and you have representatives from that agency here to speak following me. But the one thing I do want to point out that has been a question appears on page 25, and this is basically the description of the ASAP program. One thing that DHSS does is run the Alcohol Safety Action Program, and in SB 91, at the suggestion or recommendation of the commission again, you limited that program to take referrals just for DUIs and refusals. So if the court sentenced somebody for a DUI, they can send them to the ASAP office and have that person get assessed for whether they have treatment needs and the extent of those treatment needs. And there had been mission creep, basically, and the courts were sending people to ASAP for alcohol-related incidents other than DUI and refusal. And by the bill, you expressed your intent that ASAP's mission would be limited to those two. At the same time, though, and I will point out page 27, traveling through the legislature was SB 165, a completely separate bill that changed the treatment, and it passed, of minors consuming alcohol. That had formerly been a misdemeanor, and as of last session, well, it went into effect last October, it's now a violation. It's a violation, meaning no jail time, punishable by a fine of $500, so you get a ticket. Minors who are caught consuming or possessing alcohol get a $500 ticket. But if you see the wording of that bill that you passed, it's a violation, but the court can reduce the fine lower than the $500 to $50 for if it's the minor's first one, $250 if their second, if the minor, has gone through the Alcohol Safety Action Plan or a juvenile ASAP program or a community diversion panel. So there was a disconnect in that the legislature recognized that juveniles could go to ASAP, and yet in SB 91, there's no authority for ASAP to handle these juveniles. It has not been a true problem in practice because ASAP has generously been handling the juveniles because they did it before SB 91 anyhow, and I have no idea how many have gone to them to seek a reduction. But that would be something that would be a technical fix in my point of view. That's all I have on the bill itself. If there are questions, I'd be happy to take them, and otherwise I will roll into a discussion of the statewide bail schedule that I heard brought up at the last meeting.
Thank you. And what my intention is to go ahead and get these out in a single sheet explanation as we go through in some drafting, and then we'll have a conversation in the committee. So I'm not going to do anything until we've had some conversation amongst the committee members and maybe hammering it out here in a committee meeting. So please proceed.
The court system has always promulgated bail schedules. What a bail schedule is a document that tells law enforcement and jails that there are certain offenses, they can only be misdemeanors, that will have a standardized bail, so that if somebody is arrested for one of those offenses and brought to the jail can look at the bail schedule, know what the bail is for that, and ask to collect it right then and there, and the person can be released. So if I were arrested for a DUI at 2 o'clock in the morning and I was brought to the Anchorage jail, that facility could look at this bail schedule and know what I would have to do. I might have to pay the money, it might be own recognizance, whatever the bail schedule says. Up until this past March, there were different bail schedules in the different districts because the presiding judges promulgated the bail schedule for their districts. And in some cases, there was more than one, a different one for Anchorage than Palmer, for example. But they represented the presiding judge's best estimate of what was appropriate for bail in that area in order to assure the person's presence at future future hearings in the case, and also to protect the victims in the community. So last March, the presiding judges got together and determined that it would be better for state criminal justice to have one statewide bail schedule, to have it be consistent and consistently applied. So they drafted the presiding judge bail schedule. I included in your packet, starting at page 28, what that bail schedule looks like, because there's some questions, I think, about what it does. So first of all, it doesn't apply to felonies. If you are arrested for a felony, what that law enforcement officer has to do is call the on-call judge, and we provide an on-call judge everywhere to be available to set bail, and you are put on for an arraignment at the very next opportunity, in every case within 24 hours. Well, the law says within 48 hours, so sometimes it goes further. The reasons for going further than 24 hours are usually because the defendant is too intoxicated to appear within the 24. But we try for 24. It also never applies with domestic violence, because there's a statute that says anybody arrested for a domestic violence-related offense must see a judicial officer. So they are held without bail until the next arraignment date. But there are certain things that the people can be released on their own recognizance for, with certain basic conditions. Sometimes this bail schedule will tell you on page 29, for certain misdemeanors, you have to be brought before a judicial officer. So again, we provide those on-call judicial officers 24/7. And then in paragraph 6, all other defendants can be arrested, can be released at the jail on their own recognizance. And they are told you have to obey court orders, you can't leave Alaska, you have to show up for your next hearing, and they're given a date that their first appearance in court will be. And then in section 7, you can see that the arresting officer can always call the judicial officer. Again, we provide one 24/7, an on-call officer in Anchorage, they're in person, we have night court, to get something other than this. So in any particular case, if an officer believes that that release under this schedule, for example, on their own recognizance, that is without monetary bail, wouldn't be protective enough to the community, they can call and seek another bail. That happens. It happens often, and our judges are, again, on call just for that very purpose. And you can also see in paragraph 8, if the person, if the officer has a reasonable suspicion that there was alcohol involved, there's always the condition of release that the person not possess or consume alcohol. Okay? So that is the bail schedule. I would point out just one other area, and that is on my page 34. There's also the provision in here in the user notes that if an arrestee is particularly dangerous in part because of alcohol or vulnerable because of their intoxication, they can note the special circumstances during that particular arrest and ask, again, the on-call judicial officer for something other than an own recognizance release if that's what's called for under the bail schedule. I will give a little bit of background to this because I do think it has caused a little bit of confusion. This was an effort by the presiding judges when they got together in March. They amended it again in July, and then this is the August version, so it did undergo two amendments. This was an effort to bring our bail releases more in keeping with the current bail statute. The current bail statute says, 1230.011, the presumption is a person is released on their own recognizance, and then B is if releasing a person on their own recognizance, and again that just means without monetary bail, if that will not reasonably assure the appearance of the person or will pose a danger to the victim, persons, or the community, then additional bail conditions can be set. So in recognition of some of the research that had come out of the Criminal Justice Commission showing that the state's pretrial population had grown substantially over the last 10 years, by 81%, the presiding judges thought perhaps they, you know, could do their part to ensure that fewer people were being kept in jail pretrial when there wasn't a good reason to do that. So that's why things were put on this bail schedule. That being said, we heard at the last Criminal Justice Commission meeting last Thursday, I believe it was, a bit of discontent from law enforcement. First of all, maybe not knowing that they could indeed make these calls to the on-call judicial officer in any particular case, and thinking that it was causing too many people to be released, and perhaps people that law enforcement thought should not be released would were being released under the bail schedule. And after hearing that, which was the first time I heard it, and indeed one of the presiding judges who listened had heard it, they have decided to get together and review that bail schedule. In particular, the question is with misdemeanor assaults. So again, no felons are ever released under the bail schedule, but this has first-time misdemeanor assault charges being released on their own recognizance, and there was dissatisfaction with that expressed. And again, I will say that the presiding judges are getting together and have already exchanged several emails about that, and will be reviewing whether that indeed is something that should remain on the bail schedule as a release that should be on a person's own recognizance. That has always been on the bail schedule in the first district, but things varied, and by making it statewide, it did cause a bit of consternation. So I wanted to just get that out there, and if there are any questions on this, I'd be happy to respond to those.
I think, Nancy, one of the things that I can probably add to that is between the bail schedule and I would say the understanding between the police and their courts, added our misdemeanor law changes. Many of them felt like that they couldn't hold them, and it was not an arrestable offense. And between the bail schedule and the arrestable offense question, we had people doing a crime, coming right out of jail doing another crime. And I think that wearied the police, and I understand that very, very well. So. Mm-hmm. So I think as you review your bail schedule, the other thing is one of the things that I heard was and I can't remember what jurisdiction it was, but they actually had a bail schedule based on a blood alcohol level. Is that something you think that will be considered in this question?
To the chair, that is an excellent question. I think it will be considered. I'm not sure which way it will go. Mm-hmm. I think that we have learned over the last many months that there are concerns some people have with holding people in jail for having a certain blood alcohol content, and whether the jail can A, afford to do that, hold people until they're down to a certain level or not is one question, and whether it's actually constitutional to hold people in jail merely for a certain blood alcohol level is another question. So they are looking at it, and again, I've seen emails circulate among them about it, but I'm not certain of how that will come down.
And I'll save this for the Department of Corrections, but in light of the one lady that got killed in Fairbanks by walking out, who was already had been in jail but was still not sober when she left, for whatever reason, she got run over and got killed, and it was sad. And there was quite an outcry in my community of why would we do that? So I think that'll be under consideration as we go forward, and I'll watch how you folks look at it, and then we'll have to consider from this committee how to deal with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And absolutely, that's a question for Department of Corrections more than me. But again, the presiding judges will look at that. I do want to just say one thing about the bail schedule. It has nothing to do with what's arrestable, what offenses cause law enforcement to arrest. It doesn't say people shouldn't be or must be arrested for anything else. It's just what happens thereafter.
That was the nexus, though, between us changing some of the misdemeanor laws and the bail schedule. And I think the outcome of that was unacceptable all the way around. And so as you're working on yours, we'll work on the rest of it. So.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions at this point? You zipped through it, Nancy Mead. Thank you very much. And so a personal note of thanks from me. I know that as one of the lead on Senate Bill 91, it created no small task for the court system, but I know personally, with you talking to the different prosecutors and defenders and even the police, it's so important that the information was given out, and I thought you did a yeoman's job. So gratitude from me especially.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And as you can see, both technically and practically, just implementing a large omnibus bill, we knew we were going to have some wrinkles. So at this point, thank you, Nancy Mead, and I'd like to bring up Diane Castro, who is with the Department of Health and Social Services. Thank you. And probably had less of an intensity as the court system did, but certainly had no small part to play.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Diane Casto. I'm the Behavioral Health Policy Advisor for the Department of Health and Social Services. And you are absolutely right. While we have some impacts from SB 91, not nearly the impacts that the court system or DOC have. But I will say, and I think this is really important, that as we know, last year there were two critical and large pieces of legislation that were passed, SB 91 and the criminal justice reform, and SB 74 and Medicaid reform.
Yes.
And one of the things we are looking at in our department is the integration of those two, because they are critically linked. If you look at SB 91 and all of the issues related to getting better behavioral health services, mental health, substance abuse, issues that you were just talking about regarding individuals going into our prisons who are intoxicated, is that okay? Is that not okay? All of those things are really tied together. And with the partnership of SB 74, we are really going to be able to better impact that piece of SB 91 and the things that are tied to our department. So that's kind of how we are looking at SB 91, not as just a standalone, even though there are specific things that were included in SB 91 that are explicitly for DHSS, but also how do we really look at the broader system and the Medicaid reform so that we can do a better job of meeting the needs of SB 91. So we actually have established a SB 91, SB 74 Integration Initiative Work Group. Ooh. That's a mouthful. And I am chairing that group. It is a group that includes a variety of stakeholders of different departments, of different divisions, you know, and we're meeting on a monthly basis to just keep up to date to make sure everyone knows what's happening with this bill and how it impacts, how both bills are impacting our work. And it's really been an really good group of people. At our last meeting, we had presentations on Medicaid-assisted treatment and how we can, some of the new federal dollars that are coming in and how that will impact our ability to do a better job. This time, we're having some presentations on the use of Vivitrol through our partners reentry center, and then with some of the steps that DOC will be taking as they move forward with the use of Vivitrol as people are exiting the system. So those are just things that we are looking at, and you know, again, these bills are intricately aligned in terms of how we do a better job of making people who are getting out of prison, going into reentry and back into their communities, healthier down the road. So the things I want to talk about that Jordan had asked me to talk about are the recidivism reduction grants, which were a part of SB 91, and $1 million of fiscal note for the department, where we are with that, to talk about the changes within the Division of Public Assistance, the changes to food stamps and or the SNAP program and the temporary aid program and the new regulations around that. I'm going to talk a little bit about our Medicaid enrollment of this population as well in that, and then we'll turn it over to Tony Piper to talk about our ASAP program. So if that's okay, that's how I will proceed.
The only thing that I would add, Diane, is I think people need to understand that you had regulation packages that went with several of these.
Yes.
And you might just give us a flavor of the timeline of that as you go through it.
Excellent. So the first thing I'll talk about is the recidivism reduction grants. And as part of SB 91, there was $1 million that was awarded to or given to the Department of Health and Social Services to enhance and expand our community-based reentry efforts so that, again, people who are coming out of our institutions have an opportunity to get the services they need and then can become hopefully healthy and productive members of society and not recidivate. That's our goal. So we did get the money. We went through a process of kind of determining how we wanted all these programs to look. We currently, before this money, we had four reentry coalitions, one in Anchorage, Batsu, Juneau, and Fairbanks. And these reentry coalitions received initial funding from the Mental Health Trust Authority last year to get them started, and one of the first things they did was a assessment of their community and what were the needs and the gaps in services for their communities. I did some exchanges of information with those four coalitions prior to this meeting, and they are still looking and kind of analyzing those results. But basically what it found is that there, in most communities, there is a lack of, not always a lack of services, but a lack of services at the time they are needed. So it's a lack of capacity in terms of those services and the ability to get those services quickly, which for individuals coming out of prison, that's a very important thing. So with the combination of Medicaid, being able to enroll some of these individuals in Medicaid and have that payment option, they can also get more, get quicker services. So we did put a request for proposals out. The fall, October, and we broke up the request for proposals into three categories. So we were looking for the four existing coalitions' money to enhance and expand their services with a particular focus on case management services, because, again, we know from the work that our coalitions have done as well as national work that case management services are a critical piece for individuals getting out of prison. If you've been in prison for even, you know, a short time, but for some 20, 25 years, knowing what services are available, how to access services, how to get into a service system is really difficult. So the four existing coalitions were able to apply for money to expand their services and to hire and or coordinate case management services for their community, for all the individuals getting out in those four communities. We also put in money for a developing grant programs, and we got one response for that, and so the Kenai-Soldotna area got funding to begin really developing. They had a coalition, but they didn't have any funding, and so now they are going through the stages of doing an assessment, looking at their community, getting the coalition working, and figuring out what it really is that they need in the Kenai community. So they received a grant. And then the third grant that category was kind of emerging. And so one of the things we are hoping to do over time with this $1 million that does extend into next year and 2000 and beyond is to have a reentry coalition at least in every community where there's a DOC institution, right, so that those individuals getting out from those communities will have a case manager, will have services, will have a coordinated effort. So for this year, we had one application, and that was from the Nome community. So they are just starting and just developing their work and pulling together. So those were the people who received funding and the funding they received for what purpose they received. And those funds will go on. It was a one-year grant with continuations for the next few years with some additional funding next year. I believe it's $2 million that is going to be available for those programs. And we're hoping not only to add some funding to those, especially the emerging one in Nome, but then to also get responses from, hopefully, from Bethel and from Ketchikan, where we also have DOC facilities. So that is our goal there. And right now the grantees are working. We're we're looking right now at training for these grantees, having some opportunities to work together, because one of the things we know in this kind of work, particularly in coalition work, is that peer work and being able to meet with other people and talk. So we're working on some additional services to assist them and help them move forward. One of the things I also wanted to mention in terms of, and this kind of goes back to the comment you made about the person in Fairbanks that was released with a high alcohol level. One of the things we also got last year, not related to either of the two bills, but as part of the department's fiscal note, budget, is that we received some additional money for new substance use disorder grant programs. And so we received $6 million over 3 years, and those awards were for three different categories. It was for sobering centers, for detoxification centers, and or for treatment programs. And so the awards literally were just announced today.
I saw that.
Did you see
Fairbanks
that?
Fairbanks is
and
on
so
the list.
Fairbanks got $500,000 for a sobering center. So that is the perfect kind of a program that can meet some of those needs that we were just talking about, of people getting, you know, having a high level of BAC level and needing a place that is not prison but can go and get sober, and then hopefully we can then intervene and get them into treatment as well. So that was good news. And the other two, just as a side note, Central Peninsula General Hospital received money for a 6 to 8 bed detox center withdrawal management, and then Set Free Alaska in the Mat-Su region received money for treatment services to serve women, pregnant women, and women with children.
Right. And I know all three of those areas are, the need is greater than you can supply, and the timing is too tight, but it's still, you got to move forward.
But it's, so yeah, exactly. So that's better than nothing. So right. We're very excited about getting those dollars out and moving forward, because those are critical needs that we have, and we need to keep working on that. The second thing I want to talk about was the change in Division of Public Assistance, and the change, the elimination of the restriction on those with a felony drug offense that they could not receive food stamps, SNAP program, or temporary assistance. So that we were the last of seven states that still had that kind of a barrier in our law. That was taken away through SB 91. And now we are able to, with conditions, I mean, it's not just a free pass that you can just automatically get these services, but with certain conditions and certain requirements that they have to meet, they can now access those services. So the conditions are their felony drug conviction had to occur on or after August 22nd, 1996, and then they had to complete one or more of the following: having satisfactorily served and completed a period of probation or parole, are in the process of serving or have successfully completed mandatory participation in drug or alcohol treatment programs, have taken action toward rehabilitation, including participation in a drug or alcohol program, and are successfully complying with the requirements of the person's reentry plan. And so those are things that now, if an individual with a qualifying felony drug conviction, they can come in, they can apply, and then they have to provide documented proof of meeting these requirements. So it's not just taking someone's word for it. So I was able to pull a little bit of data, because I really like to make sure I can give information that has some meaning to it. And within the Division of Public Assistance, first of all, they've changed their policies and protocols. They've sent that out to all their staff. They did that at the end of July with all the new the process for how they're going to meet these requirements. And so they are changing their internal policies and procedures. And while their database system at this point can't give us exact numbers, just because you know when you get new criteria, then you have to change your database to get the right information, but they did a review of their data and can give us a very good estimate that as many as 250 individuals out of about 489 that met that category that had applied at some point with a felony drug conviction. So they were 489 who were previously denied food stamps. 250 of those now are eligible and receiving benefits. So that's an approximation. It's not an exact number. But about 250 new individuals since August 1st have been able to submit their application for food stamps, meet the requirements that were in the bill, and are able to now be on and receiving food stamps. For the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program, there were about 75 individuals who had previously applied for and been denied based on their felony drug conviction. And at this time, three of those have reapplied and been deemed eligible and are now receiving ATAP services as a result of SB 91. So we are, I think that program is moving forward very quickly. You know, it is a little more time intensive, but that's okay, to be able to go through there, make sure they have the right documentation to show that they have met those requirements. And then kind of along that line, I did want to talk just briefly about some of our Medicaid. This is not part of SB 91 directly, and it's not part of SB 74 directly, but with Medicaid expansion, many of the individuals who are justice involved, who are coming out of our prison system, or who are already in the community having been on probation, were not previously eligible for Medicaid. So most often they had no coverage and were unable to get coverage. Now with Medicaid expansion, that population is an eligible population, and so we are really tracking to make sure that those individuals, find my right information here, that they are able to get enrolled and become eligible, because what that will do is provide an opportunity for them to have immediate access when available through our supply of mental health services, of substance use disorder services, as well as primary care and physical care. One of the things we know is that this tends to be a fairly sick population. You know, they have not always taken care of themselves. They've often, over their lifetime, have not had easy access to health care or behavioral health care. And so, you know, if they've been using drugs and alcohol much of their life, if they've been homeless, if they've, you know, there's a lot of health needs. And so we are really trying to make sure we can get this population covered and get them to a point where they can deal with their substance use and their mental health conditions, which are often the drivers of their criminal behavior. And so how do we get them into services? And so part of SB 91 was, how do we get these individuals signed up for these services 90 days prior to release?
Right.
So that as they release, they immediately are covered and can go into the services they need. Because it's often that gap from the time, if they've been in treatment while they're inside an institution, then they get out and it takes, you know, 3 to 6 months to get coverage or to find a service, then we often lose them, and that's when they recidivate. So if we can get them into services immediately, we're going to have much better success at keeping them out of our institutions. So at this point in time, we have, and again, these are approximations right now, but it appears that through DOC data, 445 inmates were provided with a Medicaid application while they were still inside an institution. 131 of those were completed and mailed to the Division of Public Assistance, and 36 individuals refused to take, complete, or submit an application. One of the challenges we have with DOC, and they are working on this very diligently, is that we do not have internet access within the facilities. So all of the inmates that are applying for Medicaid while inside our facilities have to apply on a paper and pencil application, and those take much longer to process and get through the approval process. If they could apply online through the online healthcare process, it would be much quicker. So they are working on that, but at this point in time, we are moving forward with paper and pencil applications. And so that was the information from DOC. And then I talked with DPA, and they said that at this point in time, that as of January 2017, 229 individuals are enrolled in an incarceration subtype, which they have a code for, incarceration subtype. Those subtypes are two different types. It can be that they are needing a 24-hour or more outside of the facility hospitalization, and Medicaid will cover those if they're out 24 hours or more. So there's a special code for that. Or it means that they are still incarcerated but getting releasing soon, and so they're in kind of a holding pattern, so to speak. They're eligible, and as soon as they are released, it will get turned on to be an active individual. So approximately 156 individuals that are currently enrolled in regular Medicaid that previously were in one of these subcategories. So we are making progress, and we are very hopeful that this is going to be a huge boon to those individuals who need ongoing health care and behavioral health care services. So with that, I think those were the, let's make sure. Yes, so now what I would like to do is turn this over to Tony Piper. As you know, and there were some changes made to the requirements, and this is where most of our regulations related to ASAP program and some of our testing, and Tony can talk about that, but all of those are in process.
Thank you, Diane.
We had a huge list of regulations that we were working on.
So. And Jeff, time is going to be pretty tight. So I can give you a last say, but you might have to condense yours down, because I want to hear the question that Tony Piper is going to bring up on what we required of ASAP. And Tony, we had heard in the commission that the mission had got broadened so much that you just couldn't do. And then I hear from other groups where they aren't so bottled down. So can you give me, when you put yourself on the record, give me some concept of the difference between, say, you that manage it in the Anchorage area and other places that may not have quite that problem, because I think that's what we're going to hear about in public testimony. Mm-hmm. So, Tony, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tony Piper, and I'm the manager for the Alcohol Safety Action Program statewide. So let me start out giving you some numbers, generally speaking. In the ASAP office, for the first 6 months of this year, we had 1,801 clients go through. Compared to last year, the first 6 months, we had 3,218. So it decreased about 40% or so from what we're used to seeing. And out of those 1,801, 1,609 were within the guidelines of what SB 91 has coming to ASAP, and then there were another 192 which were outside of those guidelines, and those included some assaults, some DV assaults, and alcohol import, shoplifting, and various other activities that were outside of the realm of SB 91. And so we've been able to handle the referrals to ASAP so far throughout the state. What we've done and been mandated to do is come up with screening, which we have. We have a screening tool, level of service inventory, which is a risk needs assessment, exactly the same one that's used in Department of Corrections and with the DUI and drug courts. But we have a shorter screening form that we are using. In October, we held a training, had all of our offices come in for that training. Everyone learned how to use the screening tool. We've supplied all the offices with the screening tool. We've come up with some, and we're still working on the regulations themselves, but we've come up with some standard procedural processes that we are using now for the tool itself and how to monitor those people at different levels of risk without overwhelming people, but making sure that we are monitoring enough so that people are processing through the system the way they are intended to. We have follow-up calls with the ASAP office around the state to ensure that people are following the procedures and also answer a lot of questions because this is relatively new for all of our offices. And so there's a lot of questions and a lot of unanswered things that the offices have had so far. We're also working with our MIS, our AK AIM system, to make sure that we have include that element in our system so that we can have some continued quality improvement and look at some outcomes as the data starts to roll in. And as of after the training, we've had some practice time where people are doing screenings, but as of January, we implemented having people that are coming through, all of them are at least being screened and monitored with some increased monitoring, but we are still making some changes to that and still working on those regulations. We hope to have them done within the next couple of months or have them at least in some good draft form so that we can work through some of the problems that may come up as we continue doing this. So I think that's the information I have for the screening and risk needs screening for the ASAP offices, and I'm open for questions.
Sure, and I think there are going to be some questions. I don't know that today is going to be the best day for it, but so your regulation package is going out, and simultaneously to your regulation package going out are going to be some questions on was that the right thing to ask you to do. And so just kind of keep that in mind, and as we roll out recommendations, I think you're going to see some people ask that in the building. I've already heard it twice since I've been in town, so I haven't been in town that long. So, but first of all, to you and all the people that work in your program, thank you. I think Alaska depends upon you in so many ways. They just absolutely depend upon you, and you're part of the public safety element that is just as essential. So, now it's a matter of making sure that we don't mess up your life too much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have a few minutes left, so I'm going to have Jeff Jesse come up. Thank you, Diane Castro. Thank you for filling us in on that information. And my apologies to anybody who came for public testimony. I wanted to get some of these things out on the record, rolled out, and then we can go into some public testimony later. So, Jeff Jesse, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the legislative liaison for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And I want to touch on just two things today related to implementation. One is the progress that's been made at the University of Alaska Anchorage with the Justice Information Center. You may recall last session we engaged the Justice Center in looking at the Results First initiative, and we partnered, trusted, with the legislature to get them started and to get some activities going around that Results First area. And they've been doing their work, and I'm going to throw a few numbers at you. There are 52 criminal justice-related programs trying to deal with recidivism. And when the Justice Center looked at those 52 programs, they went and tried to match them to evidence-based practices in the literature. And overall, out of those 52 programs, 58% matched. So that's good information. Now, this one's really interesting. 65% of those 52 programs are state-funded to the tune of about $23 million. 89% of the state-funded programs match to evidence-based practice.
This is good news.
That's very good news. It means that most of your money, the vast majority of your money, is going to evidence-based programs. And, of course, now the task will be to continue to monitor the fidelity of those programs, to look at their outcomes, and start fine-tuning these as we go through this entire process. The point of this entire justice reinvestment and reform movement has to be data-driven. If it's not data-driven, it will drift, I guarantee you, it will drift off course, and we'll be back in a few years going, well, how come that didn't work the way it was supposed to? The next step for the Information Center is to start to do the cost-benefit analysis. Now, those of you that have been here a while may have gone to some of the presentations by Dr. Stephen Oss from Washington, where he has pioneered this work, but the Justice Center is going to be doing this as well. And what this involves is to say, okay, for this amount of money, we're getting these outcomes. Now, is that the best bang for our buck? There may be some programs that get really good results, but they're really expensive and they don't cover very many people. Other programs may not get quite as good a result in terms of numbers of outcomes, but they're pretty inexpensive, and you can cover a lot of people with them. And so as we move forward and we look at limited resources, we're going to need this information in order to decide, well, okay, are we better off investing in this program or that program? And then as we look at these different areas, for example, one thing the Information Center is going to be doing is looking at what they call trips through the criminal justice system for seven different crime types. In other words, take a look for different crime types. You know, how many resources are being spent on individuals that come through the system in terms of police, court system, corrections, and then start to look at, okay, where do we best apply the resources we have to get our best return on investment? I know it's not all about money, but it's all about money. I mean, we have to have a sustainable program and get the most bang out of our buck. Now, the next step, the trust has only recommended two very small general fund increments, and obviously I don't have to tell you why. These are tough times, and the trust has agreed to match funding for both of those. And one of them is to increase the funding to the Justice Information Center so they can take the next step in their evolution, which is to become an integrated data platform for criminal justice data so that we can gather data from the different parts of the system, many if not most of which don't talk to each other very well, gather that information in a central location, and then analyze it in order to be able to provide feedback to this initiative as it goes through its evolution. We think that's a mission critical activity. And that's why we've been willing to partner with you to make sure that we can stand that up. And they're working very closely with the Judicial Council, which supports the Criminal Justice Commission, and so they have partnered up. And I just have to say, the other reason I really like working with the Justice Information Center at UAA is even on an even broader scale. I think we need to make sure that we are maximizing the utility of our university system. It has to be part of the solution and part of helping with its capacity to do this kind of work, helping us solve the fiscal and programmatic challenges that we have. So we're excited to be working with the university on this. The second thing is this issue of reinvestment. And as I've thought about this a little bit more, at least in these early years, the term reinvestment isn't really very accurate, because the savings that you're going to see from Senate Bill 91 are not happening today. They're deferred. And so you don't really have any money today to reinvest in these services. So the big challenge is that, well, that means you have to invest. You have to come up with resources to front-end load these efforts, because if you don't, you're not going to get the savings to reinvest downstream. Last year, Senate Finance and Senator McKinnon were very creative in being able to use some marijuana tax prospective funding in order to jumpstart some of this effort. But going forward, it's going to be critical that we make sure that we are building up those resources so that when we do pretrial release and when we look at recidivism, we are able to give people access to the services that they need to be successful. And to remind you, I say this every time, what are those things? Well, housing, employment, so they have a legitimate source of income, and treatment and support for recovery. With those three things, then we could have success in getting people back onto a more protective course. And Diane Castro mentioned this earlier, and I just want to say this again. It cannot be overstated how critical Senate Bill 74 and Medicaid reform is to the criminal justice reform effort. Because as we go forward and we look at how to fund these different programs that are necessary, we just don't have the general funds to pour into this. We're going to have to maximize our federal receipts and leverage those federal dollars in order to provide these services. Now, of course, there's a lot of change on the horizon at the federal level. We don't know what that's going to look like. But I can tell you two things I expect to see. One is less money. So that's going to be a challenge. On the positive side, I expect to see less regulation. Right now, in order to do some of the Medicaid reforms that were laid out in Senate Bill 74, there's a huge effort to have to convince the feds to allow you to do the things that we know we need to do. If that burden becomes less, that is a good thing. So we'll be trying to maximize the benefit of whatever changes come at the federal level and mitigate any of the negative impacts. So those were the two things I wanted to cover. Again, the Justice Information Center is up and running and ready to take on more responsibility, and we've got a good start on investment and reinvestment. And with the help of Senate Bill 74, hopefully we can continue to expand those services and help achieve the goals that were set out in Senate Bill 91.
Thank you, Jeff. And first of all, I agree that data driving is going to help us make evidence-based decisions. What we depended upon Pew to do was unique in Alaska, and it pulled information out that we had not been surrendering previously and was able to correlate it to what was going on elsewhere. But the more the Justice Information Center can do that is Alaska unique, the better decisions I think we can make. So I appreciate that recommendation. And then for all involved, public safety has been the goal, knowing we have less dollars to do it with. So we had to think about cost shifting and reinvestment simultaneously. And so that was a tough thing. And so, as you can see, committee members from today, implementation actually hasn't gone bad. It's just that it showed that there were some places where we could tighten up better. And so some of that investment and some of those places, like the court system, brought out several really kind of technical issues to make things work better. And so there's more to come on that. But what we'll do is we'll probably try to get the commission to lay out before us some of the issues that they discussed today, deliberated on, and come up with recommendations. I'll try to lay those out. If I can get those documented to me before Monday, I will make sure that you have them as soon as I get them, and then we'll go over them in committee, all right? Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for coming in, listening to us, and for those listening online. Thank you for being a part of this particular hearing, and so we're going to adjourn at 1 minute to 3:00.